Hello and welcome to Radio Edutalk. My name is David Noble in Dalgetty Bay in Scotland, and delighted to have on the show this evening Vivian Ming, who is over in San Francisco. Good evening, Vivian.
Good evening. How are you all doing?
Yeah, well, not bad at all. And it's just myself this evening. John, my co-host, is presenting the Wednesday evening show, but hopefully we'll have some listeners to the live show. And I'll just say at the top of the show that you can get in touch with any questions or comments for Vivian on this evening's topic of meta-learning. You can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up on Twitter with the hashtag Edutalk. Vivian, could you just start off by maybe giving us an idea about, I suppose, firstly, where you live and also your workplace and maybe your research interests?
Absolutely. So I am a theoretical neuroscientist by training and still to this day am a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. So theoretical neuroscience, where we try and figure out the brain based on mathematical principles. But about 8 years ago, I got the bug. I got what happens to, I think, everyone in the Bay Area here and Silicon Valley, which is I needed to create my own startup. And my wife and I co-founded our first company all those years ago in the education space, trying to unite the sort of computational modeling work I did to understand the brain with her work in the learning sciences, trying to understand students and teachers in the context of learning. And in all these years, I haven't lost my passion for it. We are on our fifth company called Socos, which is based in Berkeley, California. And we provide both educational research and data mining services, but also a core product based around truly understanding what's going on inside of the heads of students. To put it in somewhat ridiculous terms, we want to give teachers and parents a superpower to understand what's going on inside their children's minds and then know what to do next.
Sounds great. Sounds like it's going to be a real interest in the next half an hour or so with your guest, Dr. Vivian Ming. Now, Vivian, I'm wondering where this particular interest that you have at the moment kind of comes from. I know that there was a quote in one of your papers, and there's links on our Twitter account and on the homepage, edutalk.cc. But am I right in saying that a lot of your passion kind of comes from this idea of, first of all, the idea that the education system is very much failing many of our students, and also that society and business are missing many kind of diamonds in the rough that are out there.
Yeah, but certainly a crucial idea. And I should start by giving education here in the United States and throughout the industrialized world the credit that it's due. It's an amazing creation that when you think about the process of taking millions and millions of people every year and passing them through this system to become creative parts of society. I think we should be proud of the foundations that the industrialized world has laid for trying to bring its entire population along into this amazing time that we're in. But there's no doubt that we could be doing better. And clearly that's a big issue in the United States, where one of our particular issues is really about equity, that if you break up the performance of the United States on economic terms, say into five groupings based on the financial strength or the wealth of local communities, you'll find that on international standardized tests, every one of those groupings ranks the highest in the world against economically matched international competition. Not that I think education should be thought of competitively, but I'm simply trying to make the point that even at the lowest level of economic success in the United States, our schools actually do very well against equitably matched countries around the world. But that bottom quintile does vastly worse than the top. So it isn't that we don't have some idea of what to do, it's that we don't know how to distribute it equitably. And the result is that enormous numbers of people slip through the system and never achieve the potential that they could have. They're never able to go beyond the limitations of their community, which should never be the defining characteristic of a person. You know, the idea that you might never have the chance to become a doctor or a software engineer or a founder of a company simply because of your, a quirk of your birth, your postal code, is, I think, enormously tragic, and not just for that person, but because there's a cost that we all bear societally, a real economic cost, if that's the thing that moves you. So it took us, what we've really focused on is how can we create technologies that are extremely low threshold, low cost, easily deployable, but bring those students and their families along with the same level of success as the highest performers. To get a little more specific, what our core belief is, that really comes in large part from my experience as a neuroscientist, is that we should be able to take naturalistic data. So that's a very wonky term, but we should be able to take data that students are naturally producing when they're learning. All of the discussions between students with their instructors, homeworks they might be creating, drawings in college education, the digital footprint, the online discussion forums, emails, everything that's coming out of a student in the moment of learning, and turn that directly into a predictive assessment. Rather than waiting for the end of the course to figure out whether they learned what they should have, we should be able to do that right away. And in fact, we published a paper in several iterations in which we showed we in fact could do that with college students. In particular, a large group of students, undergraduate college students in a biology course, and then an even larger number of MBA students in an economics course. And our system learned biology, it learned economics by monitoring the online discussions between the students in those courses. So there was no expert involved, nothing was pre-trained, and all we looked at was those discussions. We didn't look at the homeworks or the final exams. Then 20,000 new students entered those courses, yes, very large courses, with new instructors and new assessments. And we knew at week one what grade they would get. And as the course progressed, we knew with greater and greater accuracy the details of that final score, what they would get wrong or right, for example, in the comprehensive exam. And the purpose of this being, if we knew at week two that a group of students were not going to understand an idea introduced at week three of the course, then we can recommend a set of interventions, a set of alternate experiences that have been shown to be effective for that type of learner, all of which, again, is very, very data-driven in our context. We're collecting all this information. We're building our assessment. And then we're monitoring, additionally, all of these experiences that the students are having so that we can go back and say, well, of the ones that ended up successful, what were the set of experiences that led them there? At this point, I could detour into a very wonky discussion of the conditional Bayesian probability models that we use, but probably not great radio.
So the... No, it's a great introduction, Vivian, and this is all about kind of flipping assessment, so to speak, into a form where it's connecting I suppose the adults and the educators around a young person or a student, and possibly even their families, with the student's long term goals, rather than what it is just now, the kind of measurement of things that have been learned previously.
Yeah, what's interesting that you mentioned long-term goals, because now I'm going to immediately say that what I just told you is a failure. It's not a complete failure. It worked. It genuinely works. But for the last 2 years, I was chief scientist of a company called Guild, because I wasn't doing enough in my life, and I decided I needed to have a second company as well. And Guild is a wonderful place that does something similar in the space of working professionals. So we help employers make unbiased hiring decisions by building these sort of independent predictors of employee performance. And I just recently stepped down from being chief scientist at Guild so I could refocus all of my attention on Socos. But one of the most powerful things I learned from the research I did there was that grades and degree and standardized tests all were virtually of no value for making these sorts of predictions about worker performance, that they added nothing to our efforts to determine whether someone would be successful inside of a company. And further, there's an enormous body of literature that says the same thing more generally about students. And not just about productivity, but about all sorts of life outcomes. So not just lifetime earnings, but educational attainment, health, sort of squishy ideas like happiness and social health, all have strong predictors in the experimental literature, but almost never the sorts of predictors that we capture either in our standardized testing or in the typical types of assessments that are used in a school setting. So it led me back to this idea, why am I building this very sophisticated system for predicting grades if grades themselves are not predictive of anything? So what we've rebuilt as of today is a system which takes naturalistic student data, creates a predictive assessment, which is aligned not with course outcomes, but with life outcomes, but then makes intervention recommendations back to parents and teachers that are in the context of the course. So, and this is through a very broad concept of meta-learning. So this is a broad idea that there are these sets of attributes of an individual. Take, for example, it goes under a variety of names: emotional intelligence, social intelligence, metacognition, generalized cognitive ability, grit, mindset, endogenous motivation. There's this wide and varied literature around things that are actually genuinely predictive of life outcomes. And we're using this umbrella term about meta-learning, which is really learning how to learn. And it turns out that those are the things that are truly predictive. So when you look at students in college, in high school, where a lot of the research has been done, and in fact at Google, where they did this research internally on their employees, the predictors of success, not simply graduation, but of life success, were these sorts of meta-learning qualities, such as endogenous motivation, this drive that comes internally from the student rather than as an external, say, punishment or incentive program. And so that's what we align around now.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, you know, be many school teachers, Scottish, UK based, further afield, and maybe like myself, when you hear that kind of phrase meta-learning, you think like, I'm a school teacher myself day to day, and you kind of panic a bit and think, well, you know, I wasn't taught how to teach meta-learning at teacher training college. So, you know, does this make the teacher redundant, or does it change your role? And yet when I read a little bit more about some of your literature, you then seem to link in kind of success with meta learning to maybe early nurture within the family or within kindergarten or social settings.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I've got to say is both, not just, this isn't just an abstract educational statement. This is, I'm going to make a statement here of just the reality of being an educational technologist, which is, and I will criticize some of my fellow technologists, which is to say that there's this drive. For example, there's an XPRIZE right now to reward someone who can come up with an AI that will independently tutor students. And we'll distribute it all over Africa, I believe, is the vision. But a lot of the prominent players, such as the MOOCs and many of the educational game providers, those few that are legitimate, are really creating these totally enclosed experiences that at best turn the teacher into sort of an assistant in their own classroom. And I very much don't believe in that. The hard part of education is engagement. And there are only two groups of people that are ideally and continuously engaged with students, and that is their parents and guardians and their teachers. And if you write them off out of the system, you have guaranteed that your system will fail. And I think that's something that a number of MOOCs like Coursera have learned the hard way. And it's a lesson, however, that so many others have not understood. So although we're doing a data collection largely around the student, where we are truly supplying a product, a value, is to the teachers and to the parents. And so in that sense, I think that providing tools to teachers is fundamental. It won't work otherwise. Having said that, do you get trained in how to actually engage around meta learning? And unfortunately, you don't. There is some elements in the new American Common Core standards that are around sort of social-emotional engagement with students. And it's been a challenge point because although that's in the standards, it isn't clear how that's supposed to be either taught or assessed, simply that students are somehow supposed to reach these goals. I think it is both possible to assess it, and it's possible to provide tools to the teachers and parents to actually generate it. But it's crucial that it becomes an engaged, broad view of the student, that at its heart, we need, this is what long-term education is about. It's about building in crucial attributes, such as a belief that your hard work will pay off. It is an understanding of your ability to solve problems in a creative way. And it's also about some aspects of general cognitive ability that a lot of people will write off as simply being innate aspects of a student. And yet, there is research after research showing that we can fundamentally address a lot of the disparity in student populations by changing these things. So one very tangible one is in, for example, stress, that students that grow up in high-stress households, turns out that stress is a causal factor in their having a decreased working memory span. In other words, we're making them stupider. And that may be an obscene way of putting it, but I'm trying to be blunt that this is something that's intervenable, that we can change about people, and the easiest way to change it is to reach those parents.
Mm-hmm. And you also put a kind of large value on like curiosity, creativity, exploration, and a kind of openness to new experiences. And I would assume that the research would show that stress as well as impeding the kind of working the long-term memory may reduce these opportunities or the kind of drive to take up the many educational learning opportunities that are out there?
Yeah, you know, relating what you just said to your earlier somewhat concrete question that I don't think I fully addressed, which is how can teachers teach these sorts of things? You know, if you want to teach a skill or knowledge base, in some sense, it's very straightforward. It's not that it's easy. It's just, you know, someone comes out being able to program, or they come out knowing science or how to write a good English sentence. How do you teach these things, which develop slowly over someone's life, or how do you help develop them? And how do you create these sort of dynamic environments that you just were referring to, alluding to, where students can be creative, where they can engage in individual projects? And that's part of what I think the responsibility of technologists like myself is to actually provide tools that allow teachers to manage that. That, you know, we're trying to get as close as we can to a teacher being something like an individualized tutor for a student, even though they might be managing a classroom of 30 students, because we can provide this kind of individualized insight into what will be effective and then help with the tracking of a set of students. So to give a very concrete example, we are launching a program jointly with researchers at UT Austin called KinderSight. And in that program, we will be recording everything that these kindergartners are saying in the classroom via low-cost microphones. And ideally, eventually, everything they say out on the playground, and we even have permissions to do it at home where the parents opt in. We process all of that speech locally, by which I mean it never goes on to our servers anywhere. But from that processed speech, we then will turn it directly into predictions about their life outcomes. And that may seem very abstract or distant from the immediate experience of the kids in the classroom, but in fact, there's an incredible richness there. And one of the best parts is that in addition to a dashboard for teachers, where they can log into a computer program or an online program and actually track their individual student performance and see recommendations about interventions, we also will be sending a single text home to their parents. Every single day, here is the one thing you can do tonight that will have the biggest impact on your child's life. Of course, it's the best guess of our big data, machine learning driven system. But the great thing is, once we make that recommendation, bite-sized, easily actionable, the parent reads it and can do it right then and there without any additional effort, we then the next day, and the next week, and the next month, will record the outcomes from that student, from that intervention. And so we can see across ideally, hundreds of students in our early pilots and then daily intervention recommendations, what is actually effective, update our internal recommendation system, and make new sets of recommendations. And that's how we can bring the parents along and how we can engage them in this process. There's a ton of great literature around the effectiveness of I call it just-in-time texting, and the just-in-time refers to supplying an action, a recommendation to a parent right when they need it, right when they can act on it. Hey, Dad, Maria is really excited about seahorses right now. Take 15 minutes and talk to her about seahorses. And in this young population we're referring to, everything about that recommendation is highly engineered by our internal system. Of course, the idea that a student might be interested in seahorses is something we picked up from our data analysis, but the specifics of the recommendation, asking Dad to get involved, having him talk to her rather than reading to her, the nature, the time, 15 minutes, all of it driven by what we have seen to be effective for driving life outcomes in this kind of learner.
And Vivian, do you think it's within our grasp in the future that all assessment or all feedback, coaching or what have you, could be done in this way, where it's continually, I suppose, formative rather than summative, and where the data is always naturalistic or gathered from natural settings?
So I will say this with the bluster of someone who is not a trained educator themselves, but instead a neuroscientist, although I'm happy to have my wife so strongly in line and a co-founder of the company. That first off, the value of summative assessment, historically not being in dispute, going forward, if, as we have done, we can predict the outcomes of high-stakes testing, so in this case, predicting the outcomes of final exams and final assessments, essays, and so forth, and if we know through extensive research that there are inherent biases in this sort of high-stakes testing that play out, for example, in high-stakes math tests. When I give them up front, typically as a population, boys will outperform girls. But if I then continue to assess them repeatedly on the same topic, the girls will slowly start to outperform the boys. And I don't actually care what the cause of that bias and that change is. All that's important to me is there's no way that it's providing a veridical assessment of the student. And this is where me as a neuroscientist come in. The one thing that my field has really latched onto in the last 10 to 15 years is this idea that you can't really understand the brain if you look at it out of context. So if I show you classic visual stimuli used in Nobel Prize winning neuroscience research, and then I somehow recorded the activity of cells in your brain, I would actually find that those cells would behave entirely differently than if I recorded that activity when you were looking at a true natural scene in the world. And this, again, is work that has been done, work with monkeys, watching movies versus watching these classic stimuli, and it's been studied to death in the context of the auditory system, the visual system, attention, problem-solving, language. Again and again, what we find is that naturalistic data provides the real insight, and that, in fact, it gets processed in a fundamentally different way than non-naturalistic. And so in this context of education, non-naturalistic would be high-stakes testing. And I would additionally throw in many kinds of computer-based automated assessment. Not universally so, but in many of these contexts, a student is so far removed from how these knowledge and skills are supposed to be deployed that there's good reason to think that it's being processed differently by their brain. So I'm extremely extremely moved by the idea that we can move away from classic types of summative assessment into a formative assessment that just gives you, but one that's continuous. So you can, without actually spending time on quizzes, you can just look and get an immediate sense of how each of your students are progressing. And then slightly more nuanced is this idea of a predictive assessment, which isn't simply to say, where is my student right now? But combining that with where have they been, make a prediction about where I think they're going. And in our case, of course, that is this wild and idealized prediction about their life outcomes. But really, that's what we're most interested in. Not that this is the end-all, be-all, but when you look at the economic research and workforce planning and efforts in that space, where I myself do a lot of research, you can see that the best people aren't coming away with a particular skill set. In fact, again, one of the fascinating things I found in my research at Guild was that, take software developers, for example. A Bachelor of Computer Science from Stanford University, which some very, very exciting research we did there showed was the top software engineering university in the world. Turned out that degree that I just named is only a very modest, though positive, predictor of someone's ability as a developer. In other words, if you're hiring someone, that degree from Stanford unfortunately doesn't tell you very much about whether someone is really a talented software developer. And in fact, there are a number of other predictors which are much stronger and are very deeply tied to this idea of meta-learning that we are promoting so strongly at Socos. Ironically, in the educational context, it turns out a PhD in almost anything, a PhD in philosophy, is a far and away a stronger predictor of someone's ability of a developer than that computer science degree is. But again, it's very likely driven by these longer-term qualities. The reason someone went and wasted 5 years of their life studying something so esoteric are the exact same reasons why they are self-motivated, engaged, displaying a belief that their hard work will pay off. And really, we're identifying two different, we're identifying the same quality, just two different symptoms of it. And our goal at Socos is to start when those kids are young, follow them all the way through college, and genuinely try and develop those abilities.
And Vivian, when you're talking about this kind of mining of the naturalistic data, I'm kind of interested that there was a quote from one of your documents. You were saying teachers should be free to choose the learning activities that are best suited to meet their students' needs, and that actually chimes with guidance in Scotland with our new curriculum, particularly for pupils up to around about 14 years of age. Is there not the risk though that there may be some bias there, that I suppose that works if the, you know, if you can absolutely trust that the teacher is going to work for the students with the students' needs and interests at heart? Otherwise, as I say, could there not be some kind of bias to the data? And you know, do you give advice at all? You've mentioned there about recording children's speech, and there's other case studies about mining data, text, for example, from online discussions. But if we focus with younger children, where else might you be able to get this naturalistic data from that might be as free from bias as possible?
Absolutely. So I suppose in making the statement that teachers should be in control of their own classroom, I'm really trying to combat what is perceived by me to be the other side of educational technology, the side that has not truly ever come into its own, which is that you build some computerized training system and you bring it into the class, and now the students spend 3 hours a day sitting in front of the computer, and then the actual instruction time with the teacher is based on the curriculum that came with that computer system. And again, I think teachers feel very marginalized, and that isn't a trivial issue. The public statements by some executives at education companies has been, well, it's the teacher's fault that our system isn't working, which I think is both incredibly poor judgment on their part to say things like that, but also displays their lack of an appreciation that if you can't build a product that will work in the real world and the actual ecosystem of learning, then you haven't actually delivered something of value onto the world. So part of my statement is a reaction to what's currently going on, which is this process of slowly taking over the classroom with technology, which, in fact, the kind of technology that I'm advocating for may well be so transparent that it isn't even clear that it's there. For example, in that Kindersite project I mentioned, we have some microphones around the classroom. And that's all. Other than that, there's the text and there's the dashboard. There's an incredible amount of sophistication behind the scenes. But what goes on in that classroom is the domain of the teacher. Now, I'm not saying there aren't good practices and bad practices. I'm just saying that there are a lot of very smart people working very hard on those sorts of problems that teachers, in conjunction with their administration, their districts, their professional organizations, I leave it to them to figure out how best to manage their classroom. All I am saying is that whatever they arrive at, it becomes my hard job to figure out what it means from the data. And that I shouldn't be asking people to change their teaching behaviors to fit my data collection needs. So that's a pretty crucial aspect to it. And in that sense, I think what constitutes naturalistic data, so I've referred to two things specifically so far. There's audio recordings of those kindergartners, and then there's the online discussion of college students. Really, in some sense, think of a typical day in the classroom, and ideally we'd be capturing everything. So students were sketching out math problems on a piece of paper. I would love to catch that, and I don't think that it should be obligated to happen on an iPad, for example, just to be part of our data collection. But I do think that people need to think hard about how to instrument their classrooms for data capture, which is to say, if you think about that from the start, and hopefully you don't need to change your practice to be able to capture the kind of interesting information that we and others have found to be really valuable. So, in that sense, there are people out there doing work with video and literally tracking using both data mining techniques, but automated machine learning techniques to see which students are interacting with one another. What projects are they working on? Who is moving in such a way to evidence engagement versus disengagement with the projects that they're working on? These are things that a teacher in the classroom is certainly a master teacher is able to identify themselves. You own that classroom. You almost for some that's described as a sixth sense where you just know what's going on and can pick up on those signals. But for many teachers, younger teachers or teachers that have found the profession challenging, it just isn't there for them. And one of the hopes of the systems that we're developing is really that it's a form of professional development. If you think closely about what I've described, we do all of this data capture in the classroom, and then we send sets of recommendations to teachers. Hey, here are interventions, very likely from other classrooms, that have been effective with similar types of students, thereby sharing with those teachers other tools, other curricular material, just other types of interactions with the students that they might use in their day-to-day professional lives. And I really love the idea that this is going through these crucial engagement points, the parents and the teacher, that all we're trying to do, as I said at the top, is give them a superpower. And if I can come anywhere near that, I feel like I've been successful.
And am I right in saying, Vivian, that all of this data mining and the algorithms and the working out how to provide the support and guidance towards long term goals, amending or developing or altering instruction techniques and resources to ensure that maybe predicted failure doesn't happen, but all of this is going on, but all the time the assessment is kind of in the background, as you say, it's kind of naturalistic. It's happening while the learning's going on, and therefore there's fewer interruptions to the kind of steady path of learning and episodes of learning.
You know, that's the view, and there was a wonderful piece of research. It was a project that was run in Jamaica 20 years ago where they identified severely at-risk toddlers. And for a brief period, 2 years, 20 years ago, social workers would go to the homes of their kids and work not with the children but with their parents. Again, work, engage with the engagers and teach them about nutrition and social-emotional parenting techniques. 20 years later, economists from University of Chicago, UC Berkeley, go down, study these children, now adults, and they earn 25% more than their at-risk peers. They spend less time incarcerated. Some good friends of mine did very similar research here in the United States, but they're health psychologists. So their measure of interest was cortisol levels, measure of inflammatory response, which itself is a big predictor of health outcomes. 8 years later, these kids had substantially, significantly lower cortisol levels than the kids in the control group. And this idea that with very simple, lightweight interventions, nudges, if you will, accumulated over time, even with a span of 20 years in between the period that they were delivered and the period that we're measuring their effects, those effects can be enormous. And imagine, if you will, if we could deploy that at scale. You know, we can't send a social worker to every child's home. We can't even send a social worker to every child, say, in the lower fifth of earners in the United States, household earners. But imagine if that lower fifth, we could reach them via systems that I'm describing. And we could see those kinds of gains. And I'm sticking with the economic gains simply because it's highly measurable. It turned out when you count that up, the earnings increases, the decreased incarceration costs, which here in the United States is a crazy state of affairs, the gain in health outcomes and decreased healthcare costs associated with that, these simple fundamentals where if we can actually reach these kids early, for example, as I alluded to earlier, you might actually preserve the kind of native cognitive ability they were born with. When you add that all up, it turns out it comes to $1.3 to $1.8 trillion a year added to the U.S. GDP. And now imagine, of course, scaling that out across Europe, eventually across Africa, South America. The kind of potential, human potential, that we leave on the table because we're unwilling to make an investment that will pay off in 20 or 30 years is not just tragic at a human scale, which it is. It is costing all of us. You know, if kids were bonds, they would be the backbone of the world's financial system. Nothing pays off like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer, of course, that our particular approach, collecting this kind of naturalistic data, processing it, is one of the key ways of actually delivering on the promise of human potential.
Favin, just before we wrap up, I'll ask you in a moment maybe to give us an idea about who the authors are, who the researchers are that we should be reading about if we want to find out more information, and also if you could give us some kind of contact details for yourself in terms of the SOCUS website and your presence on Twitter. I think it's interesting you're talking about cortisol levels and such like and stress, and maybe some listeners who either watched online or attended I think it was last year's national lecture at the General Teaching Council, would recall Sir Harry Burns, who was the Chief Medical Officer for Scotland, was talking around a lot about what you've just mentioned there. So it certainly makes sense for somebody like myself, even though I don't have a medical background, and you start to think about what your role as a classroom educator might be now and in the future. So it's been great having you on the show, Vivian. If there's any comments or questions that come in when the podcast goes out, then I'll be sure to pass them on to you. But can you just leave us with you know, some kind of key texts that we might wish to get a hold of, or you know, how we can find out more information about yourself and the work of you and your wife.
Absolutely, and not only do I want to toot my wife's horn, who is just an amazing education researcher herself, but the co-founder of our company, Engin Bumbacher, who is a right now getting his PhD in education at Stanford, but was formerly a student of mine as a neuroscientist, and he's from Switzerland, Turkish, and he is doing amazing work in this field of meta-learning as well, which really kind of binds us all together. So you can find out more, not just about us, but about many of the papers that have influenced us as well, at the website for SOCOS, and that is www.socoslearning.com. And if you scroll through the page, you'll find our research section where we list all of the research we've done relevant to the issues that we talked about here today, along with links to the meta-learning literature. This includes work by Angela Duckworth and Carol Dweck. And I think I need to go in. We have a reference section in which we have links to, for example, the Jamaica study I referred to, links to the life outcome predictor research, including the famous marshmallow experiment. We try to package that all together in one place. So again, SOCOSLearning.com. You can find it in our research page. And I would love to see those questions. There's nothing quite as valuable in trying to deliver something of value out into the world than to have the world reach back and share what they think is really useful.
Thank you so much for giving up your valuable time today, Vivian, and best wishes to you and your team in the future.
Thank you very much. This was a pleasure.